podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of African Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW, Washington.
Will Trump be allowed to maintain control of the National Guard in California? And some African Americans are being told the fight against immigration is not their fight. Good morning, and welcome to What's at Stake. Well, a federal appeals court appeared inclined on yesterday to allow President Trump, against the wishes of California Governor Gavin Newsom, to keep using California's National Guard for now to protect immigrant enforcement agents and quell protesters in Los Angeles. A three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, consisting of two judges appointed by Trump and one appointed by former President Joe Biden, put a stop or stay to a lower court decision to return control of the National Guard to California Governor Gavin Newsom. The panel seemed inclined yesterday to allow Trump to maintain control of the National Guard. The hearing came at a time when local organizers had vowed to continue protesting against immigration raids, though demonstrations in downtown Los Angeles have quieted since the weekend. It may ultimately be up to the U.S. Supreme Court to determine what checks, if any, exist on a president's power to deploy the National Guard over the objections of a governor. The outcome of the case could carry significant implications for limits on the use of the military. Trump has stated that he's instructed ICE to target immigration raids in cities in blue or democratically governed states. It's a page out of his revenge playbook to crush political opponents. Over the weekend, 5 million demonstrators turned out all across the country in blue states and red states to protest Trump's immigration policy. And while numerous African Americans participated in the No Kings protest, some podcast hosts and influencers have been encouraging Blacks not to participate in the protest against immigration policies, saying, "This is not your fight." This morning on What's at Stake, we're going to analyze that argument. Joining us are Tanya Kateria Hernandez, professor of law at Fordham University, an Afro-Latino civil rights lawyer and author of Racial Innocence, Unmasking Latino Anti-Black Bias. Welcome to What's at Stake, Professor Hernandez.
Good morning.
Yes, good morning. And activist writer and racism speaker Shay Stewart Booley, recipient of the New England Press Association Award and executive director of Community Change, Inc. Good morning, Shay, and thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Now I want to ask both of you, how would you describe the racial makeup of the protesters in your city? Professor Hernandez, why don't you start?
Well, I have to be very honest. I try to limit my exposure to the daily news and the cray-cray that's going on in the this country since the inauguration. And so I, you know, would probably be an unreliable narrator, as they say, with regards to, like, you know, the specifics of, like, you know, what the statistics are. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly the young people who talk to me in the past about going to protests are still going to these protests. Mm-hmm. But I've also heard, you know, the rumblings of concern about battle fatigue and a battle fatigue that did not lead to a positive outcome of this election season. And, you know, with lots of Black folks warning what was going to happen and, you know, people not listening to us. So I can see where there is both a there may be an empathy, but also so many battle scars that folks are sort of like, well, you know, maybe we do sit this one out. I think that there's trouble with that perspective as well, you know, that mm-hmm. we can unpack. But I certainly see all sides of it here in New York City.
Okay. And Shay, what about you? Do you have any sense of who's attending these protests, whether African-Americans are part of the protest or not?
So I live in the state of Maine, which is a fairly white state. However, the nature of my work, the organization of which I'm the executive director of, is a 57-year-old anti-racism organization based in Boston. So I have a lot of contacts throughout New England and further out. I can say that from what I've physically seen, I did attend one protest. It was, I'd say, predominantly white folks. I know in just my circles professionally, I'm, you know, part of a couple of groups for like Black executive directors. There, that battle fatigue that has been mentioned is very real. Mm-hmm. I know no one, for the most part, I feel like, you know, they just had the No Kings Day protest. And in fact, I felt like I was seeing Black people I knew personally enjoying the weekend while like white folks and other folks were out there. So I think that from what I'm seeing in my circles, there are very few folks, Black folks or really folks of color who are mm-hmm. attending these protests.
Okay. Well, so I have a clip here from a YouTube video, and the guests went on a 4.5-minute rant about immigrants, many immigrants, not just Latinos, and spilled a lot of racist rhetoric that you won't hear unless you tuned into one of these podcasts. But I'm wondering if this is the type of information that's being out there, if this is what people are responding to, perhaps. But it's important to know what they're thinking and saying in order for us to address the issue head on. So parent alert, there is some coarse language you may not want your youngster to hear. We'll dissect this on the other side. Let's hear that clip now.
They way nicer than me. I'm one of the ignorant ones. I don't give a damn.
Okay.
I don't
ignorant,
care.
What race and ethnicity?
Black American, Alabama, down south.
Shout out, roll
country
time.
Boy. I'm one of the ignorant ones. I don't give a damn. Did you know in my city not too long ago, two illegal immigrants, Mexicans, unalived a BLK woman, tried to rob her. Unalived the BLK woman in a nice neighborhood, and they done skipped town and got away. I stay in a small city. This is the type of stuff that's happening. For people to say, oh, they're not pulling up at job sites, yes, the hell they is. They coming through, and they doing sweeps. I'm going to tell you something, bro. I don't care a damn about nothing but the Black America agenda. I don't give a damn about no Jamaicans, no Haitians. I don't care about none of them. I don't care about none of them. Because guess what? That video that I seen with that damn Jamaican lady talking about some go unalive a Black American, don't unalive, they don't care about us. They want to come over here, make their money, like you said, set up shop illegally, send that money back to their country. And, you know, when they get tired of living here, when they want to flee or when they want to run away, I can go back to Mexico. I can go back to Jamaica. I can go back to Haiti. Like raid. Y'all in the way, to be real with you. Y'all in the way. And I heard somebody else say, that you're right. They get in these positions, right? These councilman positions, they in these senator positions, and they forget all about the Black American people. They forget about it, all of us. You know what I'm saying? And they start doing for their people. Why you think all our reparations bills get stopped? It's because of them passionate about it, dog. Because it really hurts my heart for the things that y'all want to ride the coattails of what my ancestors did and what my people do. Like somebody said, the HBCUs, they can come flood the HBCUs. But we can't get no grants from the Mexican people. We can't get no grants for none of them. And then my whole thing is this. Why are you guys up in arms asking us, We're saving our energy. Go ask the Chinese. Go ask the Asians. Go ask the Italians. It's other people you can ask, but you don't want to ask them because you already know what they're going to tell you. No. Get out of my face, boy. Get what I'm saying? So, man, look here, bro. All my Black American people, save your energy, bro. We're not going out there. We're not finna go brawl with them folks. You get what I'm saying? Because what's going to happen is, like Sister said right here, you're going to get caught up in the mix, and your ass going to be in ice. Excuse my language. You're going to get caught up. You're going to be down there in Little Mexico. Big trouble in Little Mexico. So I'm going to say this. No way, Jose. No way, Jose. We ain't going. You get what I'm saying? And guess what? We're going to hold it down right here because we ain't no fleers. We ain't no fleers. We gonna stay right here. Y'all been chasing out Black Americans out of California since y'all stepped foot over there. She ain't lying. It's plenty of stories. Moving families, displacing Black American families. Bro, look how they tearing up California, dog. It ain't gonna be nothing left when them folks get done. And guess who gotta rebuild? We do. The Black American people gotta rebuild. So I'm tired of it, bro. I don't care what none of y'all say. Y'all can call me a bigot. Y'all can call me whatever you want. You can call me whatever you want. But guess what? I'm done. My people done. We saving our energy for when the real pop off. When it all pop off for real. We saving our energy. I'm going to land right there.
I'm going to say, before we move on to the next speaker, as the host of this conversation, I also have a YouTube channel, which I will be putting this on YouTube. All right. Is going to be on my For the Culture channel, but I do have Afro Elite channel on YouTube. I talk on Twitter. I talk on this, and I hear a bunch of different people make a bunch of different arguments, trolling in the chat room. We've been seeing it here. Hundreds of people like, oh, y'all so uneducated. Y'all don't know. This is misinformation. You guys sound hurt. You guys sound bitter. You're taking a personal experience out of it. Okay. All right. We said, okay. So when you let them come up and speak, they sound like Rasta. When you let them come up and speak and I say, okay, since we sound uneducated, since we sound emotional, since we don't know what we're talking about, what's your argument?
So that's difficult to hear that rant, notwithstanding the foul language, though there's some interesting, legitimate points made. Shay, he said at the end, we're saving our energy for when the real thing pops out. If you consider that Trump said in the Oval Office that El Salvador should build more prisons so he can send, quote unquote, homegrowns to a gulag, what are your thoughts about saving our energy for when the real thing pops off?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. When I think about what Trump said, I took that personally as a, I don't think we have time to save our energy. He's been back in office a little less than 6 months. And basically, this country is almost unrecognizable at this point. We know that people are being picked up by ICE or whoever some of these people are pretending to be ICE. And we know that U.S. citizens are being caught up in this. There is absolutely nothing that leads me to think that there is no reason at some point that they will not turn their eyes on Black Americans who they feel don't fit their mold. I mean, that would be someone like myself, a professional rabble rouser. Mm-hmm. It is clear that they don't like dissent. So who is to say that they will not challenge that someone like myself, who is a direct descendant of enslaved Africans, my legitimacy in this country? You know, my mm-hmm. people have been here literally since we were brought here. But there's nothing at the current rate we're going that says that we should be saving our energy. This is a fight that involves all Black and brown people. I think when I hear people say we should save our energy, I think that this is coming out of a younger generation that has been greatly misinformed, that has, you know, they're not getting the historical data that they need to realize that historically, Black and brown folks in different pockets have worked together for our freedoms in this country. And mm-hmm. so to say, you know, I heard that and it's just like to say that that's never happened is not accurate. So no, mm-hmm. we don't need to save our energy. I understand that there are a lot of people hurt after the last election. There's quote unquote the 92% of Black women who voted for Kamala who have been sort of living a soft mm-hmm. life. Mm-hmm. It's but no, yeah. we need to work now.
Okay, let's get Professor Hernandez to weigh in on this. You're a civil rights attorney. The court is currently deciding whether Trump will be able to control California's National Guard. And depending on how they rule, that may expand to other states as well. The decision is about California now and the mostly Latino immigrant population. But should African Americans be concerned about this issue, or is it not their fight, Professor Hernandez?
Well, you know, whether we like it or not, we're in it. you know, I wholeheartedly agree with everything Shay has just said. And I kind of want to add an additional layer as well. Even if you're walking around with your passport and your birth certificate and your social security card, right, that doesn't protect you from the violence of law enforcement who racially profile you as undocumented. And we look like many of the immigrants, right? In fact, 1 in 10 Black people, right, are U.S. immigrants. So, you know, in their hard target search, and it ain't that hard, right, as far as the searching that they're doing, it is very easy to scoop us up, right? Even if we've got the blue passport, you know, boss on our foreheads, they don't care about that, right? Because this is more about terrorizing. Certainly, all the stories of people who are blessed enough to be able to travel outside the United States, when they come back into the United States, right? There are lots and lots of testimonies about Black folks who are U.S. citizens being, you know, given 2 or 3 hour inquisitions, right, from Border Patrol, even with all their documentation, right? So this is not just about like who we put away. It's also about the ways in which it creates a climate that makes it inhospitable for all of us, right? So I'm only gonna, you know, take care of me and mine. So even if you had the most self-serving kind of perspective on this, it's in your interest, actually. You are serving your interest as a Black person of, you know, of any ethnicity. Right, because we are more than one language and more than one ethnicity, to view yourself as part of this battle, because certainly those who are on the offensive think of us as all the same. And then one last thing I just want to say, if you will permit, is that another problem that, you know, some folks have had, like also battle scars in the workplace and elsewhere, where they have felt real racism, you know, I'm not trying to like undercut this, have felt real racism coming emanating from Latinos, right?
That's what I wanted to ask you about, because that young man expressed a lot of rage and hatred towards immigrants, and you're Afro-Latino. Have you heard these sentiments expressed before? I mean, you write about how Latinos hide their anti-Black racism. What can you share with us about that?
Well, you know, I guess what I wanted to concede, you know, is that there is a real history of anti-Blackness, because Latin America and the Caribbean are colonial enterprises. Right? So, you know, it's not like the slave ships only stopped in the U.S., and it's not like all the rhetoric for underscoring and justifying slavery stopped at the borders of the United States. In fact, you know, historians estimate that at least 90%, right, of the transatlantic slave trade happen in Latin America and the Caribbean, right? We're talking about 3.5% to what we now call the United States. So the legacy of slavery and all its racist rhetorics, right, are very much part of Latin America and the Caribbean. That being said, you know, giving you those sort of, you know, quick little picture statistics, right, of transatlantic slavery, the other thing that's real is that Black people live in these spaces as well. And so when we sort of talk in a very non-intersectional way about Latinos this, Latinos that, you know, part of what gets lost is that the anti-Blackness is also against Afro-Latinos. And that also means that Afro-Latinos have a Black perspective. And so, you know, I hear, oh, you know, all those Latinos they voted for, the man in office now is terrorizing us. Well, that's a very broad sweep, because unfortunately, so often the pollsters and what have you, they don't make the distinction, right? They see Hispanic surname and that's it, right? And they don't pay attention to like, no, we have racial identity as well.
And you're a very diverse population. But Shay, Shay, the gentleman in this clip raised a point about illegals committing crimes. That's a popular but inaccurate narrative. As one who educates about and against racism, do you know the truth, what the percentage of immigrants who commit crimes, what that percentage is?
So my work is more actually with white people specifically. So I can't speak to that with an exact number, but my general understanding is that that number for immigrants is far less in terms of who's committing crimes than for folks who are native to this country, homegrown, as that person would say. That has been my understanding. But again, I don't have a hard figure in front
okay.
of me.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Could I just add one thing on top of that as well? Like Shay, I don't have the exact number. But what I do know, though, right, is that even the statistics that say, you know, this X number of folks, you know, are committing crimes, the thing that doesn't get properly contextualized is that many of those things that are labeled crimes are folks who have not paid their traffic violations and so have a warrant out for them. You know, they're crimes of poverty. And this narrative, right, that they're out there doing all the killing and endangering us all, is really overstated.
Exactly. So neither of them actually mentioned the issue of immigrants stealing their jobs or getting benefits they haven't earned, but that's at the core of many of the criticisms against immigrants. So I just want to put out some facts. Undocumented immigrants in the U.S. contribute significantly to the economy through taxes and labor, while their use of social services is limited due to eligibility restrictions. The overall impact on society, they pay $96.7 billion and they cost $88.1 billion. In short, they're putting more into the economy than they're taking out. So in conclusion, their removal would devastate key industries and reduce the GDP growth in America. Undocumented immigrants are largely barred from receiving Medicaid, Medicare, SNAPs, and unemployment. They do receive emergency Medicaid. That's in life-threatening circumstances. And U.S.-born children of undocumented immigrants receive education money. There's this whole thing about some mopeds. A lot of people think, they say, well, they're getting these free mopeds. Well, I did a little bit of research on that. These mopeds that the immigrants are using to deliver food, we don't know whether they're free or rented. Many have said they cost $2,000. As often said, and this goes to the point you were making, Professor, that they voted for Trump, so let them suffer. Trump received, to be clear, 42 to 46% of the Latino vote compared to 56% of Latinos who voted for Kamala Harris. Latino men voted for Trump at higher numbers, between 47 and 55%. So there is that. But oftentimes the distinction is that, oh, they voted for Trump, let them suffer. Did you want to comment further on that, Professor?
Only to sort of echo that the ways in which even those statistics don't also give us a complete picture because of how much the Afro-Latino perspective is lumped in and not examined. And so, you know, to say Latino is really, it's not very helpful. I guess let's put it that way. It's also helpful because it's also about geography and ethnic background, right? So if you see Cubans in Miami, that's one particular very pro-Trump picture as opposed to Puerto Ricans in New York City. Right? So there is the lack of nuance that unfortunately comes with a lot of that poll data, even when they claim to be doing the deconstruction, that leaves us with a very faulty understanding of all the racial dynamics that are occurring.
And also gentrification of California. He mentioned California, and that's real. I mean, in 1980, there were 24 majority Black neighborhoods or tracts. And in 2020, there were no majority Black neighborhoods or tracts. There are 4 mixed and 18 that are majority Hispanic. So South Central LA, once majority Black, now it's Latino. So the gentrification issue, and closer to home, gentrification in the DMV, the District, Maryland, Virginia, in 1980, there were 55 majority Black tracts. In 2020, there are no majority Black tracts. 23 are mixed and 23 are white majority. So there's no more Chocolate City, as it used to be referred to. Now you have to call it Mocha City. And basically, so he's making some legitimate points, but overall, the argument doesn't carry weight because of the things that you all have pointed out. Closing statements on your part? Shay, did you have a closing statement or?
Yeah, I do, actually. I would say that going back to that YouTube clip, I think that what I hear there is a lot of frustration, a lot of anger, but a lot of misinformation. I think we cannot overstate how much misinformation is driving a lot of what we're seeing right now in terms of what people falsely believe about other people. Professor Hernandez, you have spoken, you know, passionately about like that nuance piece around when we say Latinos. And I think, you know, so I think as someone who has Black Cuban friends, whose best friend is a Black Dominican who identifies as Black but is Dominican, we're not allowing that nuance. We're smushing it down altogether. And I think that that's really harming us. I'm just going to say that there are powers to be that benefit from Black and brown people not having unity. If we're being completely honest, someone gets to benefit from us being at odds, us not wanting to support each other. And I think when you look at structural inequity, you have to look at who's gonna benefit if the Black and brown demographics of Black Americans and Latinos are at odds with each other. So I would say that it's something to really think about, that yes, we are hearing this, but I also think that on the ground organizers and activists also are not buying into that. That yes, we may not be showing up on the ground. I wanna make that very clear. For safety reasons, a lot of Black organizers are not on the ground, but it does not mean that we are not actually still behind the scenes. We're not driving things. And I say that as someone who's only attended one protest, but is connected in organizing spaces, offering advice, things of that nature. So that would be my last thought, is to really just understand who is benefiting from our not being in unity with one another. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And Professor Hernandez, your final thoughts?
Well, you know, it's less a final thought and just sort of another pitch for the nuance. Like when we think about the pain that comes from gentrification, and I live in Harlem, and so I see that and feel it too. But what people don't sort of take into account is gentrification just doesn't happen just because some white folks or others want to move into a neighborhood. It's because they are allocated space while others are being pushed out. Right. So it's not necessarily the folks who are like, oh, here's a low rent, I can afford this mortgage. Why can't we get rent we can afford? Why can't we access mortgages? Right. Those are about systemic and structural issues that are less about, oh, Latinos are taking our homes, and much more about, as Shay says, right, elites, racial elites.
Phyllis, where benefiting. Are you? Okay. All right. Thank you both very much. We just heard from Dr. Fernandez, Professor Tanya Kateria Fernandez of Fordham University, and Shay Stewart Bouley, Executive Director of Community Change, Inc. and Black Girl in Maine. And we appreciate you guys joining us for this difficult conversation on what's at stake. Up next, Trump campaigned on bringing peace to the U.S., but it appears he's sliding us into war with Israel and Iran? Question mark. Analyst Phyllis Bennis will help us make sense of that. We'll be back in a moment. Oh, 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 oh,
oh, I got my boots on the ground. Are you ready for this Sunday, June 22nd, noon until 8 p.m.? WPFW, in collaboration with Washington Parks and People, present the Jazz and Justice Festival. This event is an activation of music, poetry, social justice, and labor teach-ins, elders circle, visual art, wellness circle, and a kids corner in Malcolm X Park. Performers include Saiz Kamaladeen, Lena Saikali, Lady Murr and Friends, Paul Bailey Quartet, Blacks, Myths, Substantial with DJ RBI, Kaba Soul Singer, Proverbs Reggae Band, and the Soul Searchers, with sets by DJ Abby, Lance Reynolds, Rita Burns, and Underdog. There will also be an art exhibition curated by Adrian Ferguson of The Art of Noise, a film activation curated by Jordan Strudwick, and a community presented by Milani Douglas. The Jazz and Justice Festival this Sunday, June 22nd, noon until 8 p.m. at Malcolm X Park. An afternoon of joy as resistance. Details at WPFWFM.org.
And welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Last Friday, Israel launched a massive attack on Iran, killing 9 of its nuclear scientists. That's according to U.S. and Israeli reports, and damaging Iran's active nuclear weapons facility. Iran has retaliated with bombings, but nothing to the degree of how it was hit. And we in the U.S. might be inclined to think, here they go again with this never-ending war in the Middle East. But this time, with Donald Trump in the Oval Office, we might have reason to be concerned. Taco Don, an acronym for Trump Always Chickens Out, has been giving mixed signals as to whether the U.S. would assist its longtime ally Israel with defensive or offensive support. And Trump has changed his position so many times that I have whiplash. Joining us to discuss this segment is policy analyst Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies. Her latest book is titled Understanding Palestine and Israel. Good morning, Phyllis. Welcome back to What's at Stake.
Good to be with you, Verna.
So before we delve into the Middle East politics, let's start with the Trump administration. He campaigned on bringing peace to our country, but he has signaled that he may be supporting Israel in this war. Do we know the latest? Are American troops readying for war? Trump says U.S. knows where Iran's supreme leader is, but, quote, won't kill him, at least for now. Go ahead, Phyllis.
We don't know exactly what President Trump intends to do. That's one of the big problems. There has been, as you say, a whip-snapping shift in positions, back and forth and back and forth. You know, first we heard, right after the Israeli assault began, we heard from Secretary of State Rubio saying, this is not our action, we didn't do it, warning Iran not to attack U.S. people or U.S. facilities because we didn't do it. It was a real distancing move. But just a few hours later, we heard directly from President Trump saying, well, I didn't tell them to do it, but they're doing good. It was sort of is this a yellow light? Is this a blinking green light? Is it certainly wasn't a red light. That's part of the problem. It's not a red light. And anything other than a red light is a serious problem because it gives Israel the sense that no matter what they hear, no matter what President Trump says, no matter what anybody else says, anybody in Congress, anybody in the White House, in the State Department, in the Pentagon, what matters is what they do. And what they're doing, despite the claim that the U.S. is only helping Israel retaliate, but only helping them push back against the Iranian missiles and helping them keep those missiles out of civilian areas, we know that this war is only possible because the U.S. is paying 40% of the entire Israeli military spending and providing 68% of their weapons.
Mm. So Israel, I don't want to cut you off. I want to get back to that point. But Israel has stated that it's not interested in negotiating peace. They say Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon, period.
Actually, that's not what they say. That's the U.S. position, and it's the position of a lot of other governments, that Iran should not have a nuclear weapon. The Israeli position goes way beyond that to say Iran should not be allowed to have any nuclear capability, including enriching any uranium for any civilian purposes, despite the fact that the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which Iran is a signatory to, and Israel is not, Israel's nuclear weapons, which are rarely acknowledged, somewhere between 90 and 400 of them, are not under any supervision, any inspection from the UN or anybody else, because they are not acknowledged. But the Israeli position is way beyond the US position, saying that Israel should not be allowed to have the ability to ever create a nuclear weapon, which means that's why they're going after the scientists. That's so, why they're assassinating scientists.
So what is Israel's objective here? To destroy Iran's nuclear capability, or perhaps regime change?
Perhaps all of the above. Their official goal is to destroy Iran's nuclear enrichment capacity, its knowledge, which is why they are assassinating scientists, to make sure that no one alive has the information on how you enrich uranium. Because it's true, once you know how to do it, you can do it for either high enriched uranium for a military purpose, or low enriched uranium for research purposes, or medium enrichment for various kinds of nuclear power. They want to destroy all of that by killing all the people who have that information. They also are targeting political and military leaders, which means they are trying to destroy the ability of Iran's government to function. They have been ambivalent as well about whether or not they intend to assassinate the top leadership in Iran, particularly Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. But they have made clear that they know where he is, as they knew where many of these other leaders were. They admitted that they had Mossad agents on the ground who were placing targeting information, directly feeding it to the Israeli bombers and drones that carried out the assassinations in the first hours of the Israeli assault that led to the first assassinations of military leaders and scientists.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I want to get back to, so Israel has an estimate of between 90 to 300 nuclear weapons.
That's right.
The U.S. has well over 1,770 deployed nuclear weapons, but Iran can't have one? Explain.
Well, what is true is that the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which came into force in the 1970s, in 1976, said that there are five existing nuclear weapons states. They happen to be, what a coincidence, the same five countries that serve as the permanent members of the UN Security Council. The US, the Soviet Union at that time, now Russia, China, Britain, and France all have nuclear weapons. They, under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, they are required to do a number of things, the most important of which, Article 6, said that they are obligated to work towards complete military disarmament and nuclear disarmament. None of them have tried to do that. The other governments who sign on to the Non-Proliferation Treaty sign on are what is known as non-nuclear states, meaning they don't have a nuclear weapon, and they pledge not to get one, not to try to find one, not to try to make one. That's the agreement, which I happen to think is a good one. We don't need more nuclear weapons in the world.
That's, you really only need one.
We don't need any.
If somebody had intentions.
But the key question is, what happens when the other parts of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which, among other things, guarantees these non-nuclear weapon states the right to have nuclear power, nuclear medicine, nuclear research, all those things, and they are able to enrich uranium? That is the right that Iran has. Israel doesn't have any of those rights because it's not a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So Israel is making this claim that Iran should not only not be allowed to have a nuclear weapon, which is true, although they're in no position to try to enforce it given their illegal nuclear arsenal, but they also are trying to prevent Iran from having the right to enrich any uranium, to have a civilian nuclear program. The U.S., until about 2 or 3 weeks ago, did not support the Israeli position. The U.S. took the position of pretty much the rest of the world, saying that while Iran should not have a nuclear weapon, it does have the right to enrich uranium. And the negotiations that were underway were basically about to what level would they be allowed to enrich the uranium. Would it be only the lowest level 3%, or would it be up to maybe 60%? Would it be something in between? That's what was moving ahead. And the Iranians were operating on the assumption that those negotiations were supposed to start again this past Sunday. Instead, on early Friday morning or late Thursday night here, Israel launched this massive attack against Iran's nuclear facilities, including the massive enrichment force at Natanz, and went after, as I said earlier, went after political and military and scientific leadership across the country, killing enormous numbers of civilians at the same time. Because since they thought that the negotiations were going to be starting again 2 days later, all these leaders were sleeping at home with their families. Mm. So their families, their neighbors, were among those who were killed.
So that basically derailed those talks. Yes. Is there any chance, Phyllis, of this becoming a World War III? I mean, Iran claims Pakistan, which you didn't mention as being part of this non-proliferation treaty, that Pakistan is supposedly the only Muslim country with a nuclear bomb. Iran claims that they will drop a nuclear bomb on Israel if Israel nukes Iran. But Pakistan denies that. What can you contribute to that whole discussion?
Nuclear weapons do not have religions. Israel's bombs are not Jewish bombs. Pakistan's bombs are not Muslim bombs. India's bombs are not Hindu bombs. This is just spurious rhetoric on all sides. This kind of nuclear threat is bad for everybody. The U.S. has done it for decades, being, first of all, of course, the only country that's ever used nuclear weapons in war. Other countries, including Israel, have used their nuclear capacity to threaten other countries, even while, in Israel's case, not acknowledging officially that they even have them. So there's a lot of this kind of strategic rhetoric that gets pushed around. The question is, what are different countries doing? Right now, Israel has escalated its assault, and it is desperately trying to get a commitment from the United States to go beyond its current level of support, which, as I said, means financial and the provision of arms to Israel, which has, of course, been going on for years, and direct support in helping Israel to repel Iran's retaliatory missiles. But to ask the U.S. and demand of the White House to provide them with something the U.S. has never provided to any other country. And that is one of the giant bombs that they call bunker buster bombs. But this is not the 2,000-pound bunker buster bombs they have been using in Gaza, for instance, that are capable and have been used to destroy entire city blocks, all of the buildings, and kill every living thing on a city block with one bomb. They are asking for a 30,000-pound bomb that only exists in the U.S. arsenal and can only be dropped by a B-2 bomber, which only the United States has. So they want a commitment from the United States to use a U.S. plane to drop a U.S. bomb on the second Iranian nuclear facility at Fordo. Fordo is buried in a mountain. Deep in a mountain. It's not accessible to be bombed, to be attacked without one of these giant bombs that are specifically designed essentially for a facility buried in a mountain. It might as well have been designed for Fordo. It's never been used, and the Israelis are demanding it. The argument that blew up the other day between the Prime Minister of Israel, Netanyahu, and the U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, who ironically is a great supporter of all things Israel. He is a Christian Zionist who believes that God gave the land of Palestine to the country of Israel now, and that they should get all the support they need. And yet, he was arguing back with Netanyahu on the question of a U.S. proposal to evacuate a large number of Americans from Israel and from the region, to take them out of harm's way. The Israeli position was, you can't do that. And one might wonder, why would they be so against keeping some Americans safe? Well, the answer is, if an American gets hurt or killed by an Iranian retaliatory strike, that will push the White House, that will push Trump very hard to enter the war directly. The death of an American, particularly if it's a civilian, even if it's a soldier, in any of the bases. There are, of course, 40,000 U.S. military forces in the Middle East right now, and more heading there on two destroyers and other ships heading for the region. If a U.S. citizen is killed, that will be an enormous push towards what Israel wants, which is direct U.S. offensive involvement.
So we, the idea now is to wait and see what the Trump administration is going to do.
No,
so,
the idea is not to wait and see. The idea is to mobilize to stop it from making that decision. There are three now resolutions pending in Congress. One of them is a war powers resolution, which would reassert something that Congress has essentially abandoned in recent decades, to reassert the War Powers Act that says that Congress has to approve any deployment of troops other than if the U.S. is attacked at the last second, there would be that right. But otherwise, Congress has to approve it. That's now pending in the Senate. There's another resolution that's pending in both the House and the Senate, in the Senate led by Bernie Sanders, in the House by Ro Khanna, and one of the Republican House members, Tom Massie, who comes out of the sort of isolationist wing of the MAGA movement, strangely enough, but is supporting this idea of not allowing any military assault against Iran.
So, Phyllis Bennis, let me ask you this. Will this war, as it's escalating, impact oil or gas prices here in the U.S.? Iran has 158 billion gallons of oil, according to Perplexity, and it's the fourth largest reserve in the world. Is this war really about oil?
I don't think the war is about oil. The war is about Israeli domination of the region. But oil will be definitely a part of it. We're already seeing fluctuations in the oil market as things sort of go up and down. But this certainly will impact oil. One of the possible consequences, if there is a further escalation, one of the things Iran could do, and other countries in the region could as well on either side, would be to, for example, sink an oil barge in the Strait of Hormuz and essentially block the strait, which is where a large percentage of oil and gas from this oil and gas rich region travels. So that's one possibility. The impact on markets, just because of the sense of instability, is certainly a likely possibility here in the US, but even more in Europe and parts of Asia that are far more reliant on oil and gas from the Middle East than the US is. We have not been a major importer of Middle Eastern petroleum for many years now, not since the US began producing more gas and oil for export than any other country in the world, including certainly Iran under sanctions. But I think that the impact on the oil industry and on oil prices will definitely be seen, even if this war continues at this level, where we're seeing the deaths of large numbers of civilians in Iran, very small numbers of deaths in Israel. That could continue for some time without being resolved. And that in itself could also lead to economic consequences.
And what's the relationship to the situation in Gaza with respect to Israel's involved in now this war against Iran?
This is one of the most dangerous moments. What we do know is that the last 5 days in Gaza, the average number of people killed in Gaza every day has been larger than the combined number of people killed in Iran and Israel on any of those days. So people in Gaza are continuing to try to live under a genocide that is attacking them. Yesterday, one of these so-called food distribution centers, which have become militarized, part of the military process of going on in by the Israeli military, attacked with tanks, attacked civilians trying to get food with tank fire. More than 70 people were killed in one period in one of those so-called food distribution centers. So the conditions in Gaza are dramatically bad. The question of Hunger remains. Very few people can get any amount of food. One Palestinian analyst this morning was saying that they don't know where these claims are coming from this so-called humanitarian foundation that is a military force being staffed by U.S. civilian military forces, that they don't know where this claim is coming from, that they are feeding something like 50 mil, that they have served 5 million meals on such and such a day. He said, no one knows where these meals are coming from. No one has seen any of these meals. So they think they're just being lied to, that this is just made up for international claims. I'm not on the ground there. I can't say if anything is being made available to people, but we do know that children are continuing to die of hunger. That's what we know. People are continuing to die under Israeli bombs and tank fire. That's what we know. None of that has changed with the escalation of war against Iran any more than it did when Israel escalated its wars in these past 20 months against Lebanon, against Syria, against Iraq, against Yemen. Now it's at the most powerful country in the region after Israel itself, which is Iran. We now have the two most powerful armies squared off against each other, and it's devastating.
So Trump has his power on the international stage has, I think it's fair to say, has been diminished. We saw that with his failures with Russian President Putin and the Ukraine war. And he's ruined relations with China and Canada through his taco tariff dealings. But does this Israel-Iran conflict rest on Trump to resolve? Or what other nations will likely attempt to negotiate peace?
Well, we know that Oman and Qatar have been trying to get the negotiations back on track. Whether that can happen, ultimately, the scuttling of those negotiations, which were between Iran and the United States, but it was Israeli action, specifically the assault on Iran that began on Thursday night or early Friday morning, that made it impossible for Iran to continue, not least because the key liaison between the negotiating team and the top levels of the government in Tehran was one of the first people killed by the Israelis. That was something that they did also in the early stages of this 21 months of genocide, when one of the people they assassinated was a Hamas official who was leading the Hamas negotiating team in Qatar. Mm-hmm. So that is an ongoing tactic that the Israelis find very useful when they don't want negotiations to continue. In this case, it was not negotiations that involved them. It was about getting back to a new nuclear deal between the U.S. and Iran, like the Iran nuclear deal that President Obama had negotiated in 2015, that Trump, in his second year of office on his first term in 2018, simply abandoned, walked away from, said, we don't like it. It's not a good enough deal. I'm going to make a better deal. Mm-hmm. Well, he hasn't made a better deal. And now Israel is in a position to make it impossible for there to be any deal because there's no way for Iran to negotiate. They've said just in the last 48 hours, under these bombs, they have said, we are still prepared to continue negotiating under one condition.
Okay.
Yes. That the United States not get involved.
And that
the U.S.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time. Certainly a situation we have to continue to follow and analyze very carefully. We don't, right now, there are no American soldiers involved in this conflict, and we hope that it stays that way. Phyllis Benn is policy analyst with the Institute for Policy Studies, and her new book, Understanding Palestine and Israel. Phyllis, thank you so very much for helping keeping us on track with the facts and helping us to sort out this war of the week, seemingly.
Thank you, Verna.
So that's going to do it for this week's What's at Stake. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer extraordinaire, Michael Nasella. Next week, Dr. Marcia Coleman Adebayo will be in the host seat. Up next, Wake Up and Stay Woke with Dr. E. Faye Williams. I'm Verna Avery Brown, and in the words of the late, great Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done.
Are you ready for this Sunday, June 22nd, noon until 8 p.m.? WPFW, in collaboration with Washington Parks and People, present the Jazz and Justice Festival. This event is an activation of music, poetry, social justice, and labor teach-ins, elder circle, visual art, wellness circle, and a kids' corner in Malcolm X Park. Performers include Saiz Kamaluddin, Lena Cycli, Lady Murr and Friends, Paul Bailey Quartet, Blacks, Myths, Substantial with DJ RBI, Kaba Soul Singer, Proverbs Reggae Band, and the Soul Searchers, with sets by DJ Abby, Lance Reynolds, Rita Burns, and Underdog. There will also be an art exhibition curated by Adrian Ferguson of The Art of Noise, a film activation curated by Jordan Strudwick, and a community presented by Milani Douglas. The Jazz and Justice Festival this Sunday, June 22nd, noon until 8 p.m. at Malcolm X Park. An afternoon of joy as resistance. Details at WPFWFM.org. Oh, 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 I got my boots on the ground.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at WPFWFM.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at WPFWFM.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world one broadcast at a time.
Peace, family. On Sunday, June 22nd, at WPFW's Jazz and Justice Festival at Malcolm X Park, WPFW invites community filmmakers to join the music. During the festival, in the Josephine Butler Park Center next to Malcolm X Park, WPFW will host a community film showcase celebrating liberatory stories of resistance, resilience, and rhythm. Short works, 12 minutes or less, whether first-time experiments or seasoned productions, will be welcomed for submission at films@wpfw.org. Submissions will remain open through midnight, Wednesday, June 18th. Technical polish is secondary to vision, heart, and voice. This is an open call, and there is space for every perspective that fits under the 12-minute time limitation and reflects our community's values. Once more, the submission email address is films@wpfw.org. WPFW, making the world a better place, one broadcast at a time.
Wondering how to get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support jazz and justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
Ah, yeah. Come on, come on, come on.
To the east, my brother, to the east.
To the east, my brother, to the east. Come on.
To the east, my brother, to the east.
To the east, my brother, to the east. Yeah.
To the east, my brother, to the east.
Education, art, health, music, politics, and all things community.
Yes.
Join me, Ambrose Lane Jr., as we uncover the issues of DC communities east of the river on To the East, Mondays at 5 p.m. right here on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW 89.3 FM.
I'm Candy Shannon, and you are tuned to member-supported WPFW.